You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Sal khair. Assalamu alaikum. Good evening, everyone. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome all of you to the first event of the year that the Brookings Doha Center is organizing. I trust that all of you have had a comfortable and pleasant summer vacation and that you're back with your energies, with your hopes, and with your dreams, and are participating in the prosperity, stability of Doha as a city and of the various academic, cultural institutions that make the city a vibrant place. The topic of our event tonight is a topic that is familiar to most of you: economic diversification in the GCC. Many of us have gotten old reading about this topic, contributing to thinking about the topic, and attending events that focus on economic diversification in the GCC. Few issues in the Gulf today are the subject of a consensus like the goal of economic diversification. There are a lot of political differences that many of you have seen, observed, or maybe been affected by. There are even foreign policy differences. But economic diversification as an objective, as a goal, is a matter of unity within the GCC. You find it in most development strategies. You read about it in most national policy initiatives. And it is, in many ways, a long-standing demand that governments and policymakers have established for themselves. Nonetheless, economic diversification, in the eyes of many, has been a very challenging goal for many reasons that the distinguished panelists today will dive into, some of which have to do with history, some of which have to do with institutions, some of which have to do with external shocks and challenges. And in fact, you can suggest that the recent Gulf Rift has dealt the goal of economic diversification a serious political and economic blow. After all, one of the achievements of the Gulf Cooperation Council was to bring about economic integration in areas other than oil and gas, and thereby open the door for diversification within these economies. Where we go from here, what lessons we can take from the past, what is the future of economic diversification look like, is the subject of tonight's panel. We have assembled a group of distinguished speakers, each and every one of whom has spent time both in the think tank world, the academic world, the world of ideas, but also in the policy world, the experience world, the practice world. We will start by inviting each of them to deliver a set of prepared remarks, and we will follow thereafter shortly with an open discussion. that many of you, I hope, will contribute to by raising questions, expressing reservations, objections to what you've heard, or by hopefully pointing us in the direction of new ideas that we should be thinking about. Without further ado, and without introductions to our distinguished panel, most of whom are familiar to you, it gives me great pleasure to first invite our dear friend, Samantha Gross, from the Cross Brookings Initiative on Energy and Climate, who's flown in from Washington, D.C. to be with us tonight to deliver her set of prepared remarks.
So I want to spend my time this evening talking about an important driver for diversification here in the Gulf economies. The oil price collapse that began in 2014 was certainly attention-grabbing in this region, but there are longer-term factors at play, even now that prices have recovered. Energy markets globally have moved into an age of abundance, driven mostly by recent developments in the United States. During my first stint in the U.S. government, which began in 2002, peak oil meant peak supply. There was great concern at that time that the world was going to run out of oil, or at least run out of inexpensive oil. Engineers like myself were always skeptical of this argument. People like us tend to believe that technology will always deliver new breakthroughs. But that view that peak oil supply was on its way was very prevalent at the time, enough that it completely hijacked a number of discussions that I led at the time about U.S. energy security. Oh, how times have changed since then. Beginning in around 2005 for natural gas and around 2010 for oil, production in the United States took off as the combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing opened up oil and gas reserves that had not been economic to produce in the past. As a result, U.S. oil production increased by about two-thirds from 2011 to 2015. The United States has now passed Saudi Arabia in terms of oil production and now rivals Russia as the world's largest producer. Oil and gas resources that can be produced in this way exist in many parts of the world, and the industry is just getting started on developing those. But the United States side of the equation is not what we're here to talk about this evening. The question for tonight is how these developments can affect the energy-dependent economies here in the Gulf area. The wealth in this region is based on the world's largest and easiest to produce deposits of oil and gas. But how does that role change in an age of abundance? In an absolute sense, of course the world's resources are finite. But in an economic sense, that no longer appears to be the case. Predicting oil prices in the near term is almost impossible. If I could do that, I would be on a very nice beach somewhere with a very cold drink right now. But patterns and trends over longer time periods are much more predictable and understandable. And trends in both supply and also demand point to perhaps oil prices lower than those that one might have expected 10 or 15 years ago. I've talked about trends in increasing supply, but on the demand side, concerns about climate change and also reductions in the energy intensity of the world's economies bring talk of another form of peak oil. This time, peak oil demand. It's a parlor game these days among energy folks to predict the timing. You hear estimates from the mid-2020s all the way out to past 2040. But the actual timing is really less important. The important thing is that there's a near certainty of a peak or a plateau in global oil demand coming. So where do the Gulf states stand in this new world? In some ways, in a much better place than one might think. Oil and gas here are remarkably inexpensive to produce, with among the lowest costs in the world. But because the economies here are so dependent on energy revenues, the fiscal break-even oil and gas prices, meaning the prices that are needed to balance government budgets, are much higher than the simple production costs. And here is where the argument for economic diversification and fiscal reform really comes in. To reduce these fiscal break-even prices and keep the region competitive in anticipation of falling demand and prices at some unknown point in the future. This involves not just a change in government budgets, but really a change in the social contract with the region's citizens and the overall structure of the economy, making it less government-oriented and providing more room for private enterprise. Governments can create conditions that encourage growth, but in many cases, these are big changes for the region's populations. Since I know that there are no Saudis in the room tonight, and because it makes for an interesting example, I'll talk about Saudi reforms for a moment. Social reforms there, like allowing women to drive or to go to football games, or providing more entertainment options, serve two really important purposes: keeping more Saudis and also their money within the kingdom, and also making the kingdom a more attractive place to work and to invest. These are all good steps, but the important issue that the kingdom is facing right now is transparency. I can't say that word often enough. King Salman pulled back on the Aramco IPO recently, at least in part because he didn't want to be as transparent as the market required. The arrest of prominent royals and businessmen late last year was a real blow for the rule of law and transparency. From the outside, it looked a lot like a shakedown, and foreign investment in the kingdom has dropped sharply since then in response. So the social and business environment in Saudi is a particularly challenging case. But in all of the Gulf economies, they face another key challenge, and that's fiscal reform. Economic diversification and broad-based economic growth provide more room to make other sorts of reforms easier to swallow, things like reforming energy and water prices, the value-added tax, and reform of public sector employment practices. All of these changes have the effect of reducing the amount of oil and gas revenue needed to balance government budgets, and ultimately keeping the region's incredible resources competitive in a changing world. Thank you.
It is not part of our tradition to give an applause to each speaker who speaks, but we welcome a change in our tradition here. Thank you. يسعدني الآن أن أدعو.
I have the pleasure of inviting Dr. Khalid Al-Khater, who is an economic well-known personality, economic personality that is well-known, has a lot of presence, participation, a lot of writing, and media activities, in addition to whatever one can be said about his academic activity and his relations institutional level in the world and in Qatar. We present him today as a researcher in the economic, professor of economic and finance in Cambridge. Yes, shukran li.
Speak about what the GCC country have failed to do in 5 decades. So if you please allow me to speak in Arabic, because I have a paper that's working paper on Arabic these days, so it's easier and more fluent for me to talk and faster.
I think that the failure of the GCC countries in diversification of the economy are for two reasons. One, that they followed a wrong economic model that had failed not only in diversification but also in achieving economic stability, whether the stability of revenues or prices or growth for decades after decades. And this rate is still exposed to some cycles of failure and successes, as is the case now with surprises, technological surprises, as is the case with Shell Oil. But the question is, why do the GCC countries continue to imply a wrong economic model for such a long period? This brings us to talk about the political economic economy of the rent state, because at this on the supposition that diversification is good, but the rent economy deprives the state from its main aspect, which is distribution of the rent. And there also the issue of the changes of oil prices, and that has they have not been able to diversify the public sector, which represent the services, the infrastructure to the society, including employment of the citizens, which is by itself an objective or a goal for the public sector. So we find that according to the social contract, the state is obliged to provide jobs and professions for the citizens in return of enjoying the revenues of the petroleum and not being being held accountable for the way they spent. In fact, some resources say that about 300,000 young people who are at the age of work in Saudi Arabia are unemployed, and more than 20% of the society are unemployed. That was about the public sector. As for the capital economy, it is usually for the infrastructure. As for the private sector, it also tries to exploit and benefit from some fast gains through two factors. One, the government's generous expenditure when it has a boom in oil prices, and then the employment of foreign workforce that is of little skills but of low prices, in a way that the government doesn't find it necessary to use to employ the citizens or to use high-tech, especially because when we employ the citizens in the GCC countries, it's difficult to get rid of them in the public private sector. And this, of course, means that this very high number of migrant workers means that a lot of the money of the country is sent abroad, and that creates a lot of pressure on the infrastructure and the public services, and also encourages the inflation of prices, consumer prices, and this will lead, of course, to, and when the oil prices go down, this the economy becomes in a shrinking situation until the oil prices will go up again in a new cycle of increases, and so on and so on. Since the first petroleum shock in 1973, and this has been repeated periodically. And then, of course, the private sector also benefits from the government expenditures on both the current expenditures and the capital one, which creates consumer demand on it. As for the capital expenditure, and it does not create job opportunities to the citizens. Consequently, the reforms required for this model should target changing the structure of incentives of the economy in a way that the transform from a growth that depends on all the factors of production to change to increasing the productivity of the products and not increasing the the workers, and this requires adopting new technologies, innovation, and a change, a radical change of the model adopted at the present time to change the model from a distribution economy to one that of industrialization and export it, and this requires a reorientation of the government expenditures to be directed to the activity, the right sectors, which are industrialization and technological growth and human capital. But the question is, why the GCC countries continue to use this model of rent? This is a distribution model and not a production one, and the diversification is made on the basis of so this is a model of distribution and not a production, so it does not aim at diversifying the production. It is based on achieving the goal of the distributor, which is this regime or dictatorship, or that's to maintain the chances of staying in power and not to serve the society or increase the development benefits. But usually these elite are not elected by the people, and consequently there are some clash between the interest of the ruler and the ruled. And consequently, the result of all this will depend on the how much harmony can one create between these two sides, and how much it has failed, because it not completely fail. And consequently, this also depends on how much is the gap between the two goals. And after a certain limit of the development and building the human capital and diversification of economy and fortunes, there will be more development will be a threat or risk against the political situation, and that's why the economic growth might stop or at least be slowed down, because this would mean that there should be a change of political system to a democratic one. And this was happened in other countries in Europe, in Spain, for example, and East Singapore, South Korea, Malaysia, Taiwan. These have changed, transformed into democracy without any revolutions and killing, as is the case in the Arab world. That's why the people here have well studied these economic models. So the result of all this, what I want to say is that rent economy puts all the wealth into the hands of the political elite, and this who will use it to enforce their position. While as diversification will lead to a diversification of the distribution of the wealth, and this of course lead to diversification of the activities and the human development, and consequently that will lead to more autonomy in the work of all. And on the other side, the diversification of activities, economic activities, might create some lobbies that inside the different economic sectors, and with time, this might lead to calls for political economy, as happened in Europe in the development period. So consequently, the rent economy cannot, of any political regime, cannot be changed unless when this regime has to do so, when it finds that its very existence is at risk. And consequently, the risk of proving the economic growth might be just as big as a revolution, and that may be just as bad as not having any growth, and might lead on the other side to revolution of the hungry people, as has happened in Tunisia. So what I want to conclude with is that the decision of economic diversification seems to be a political one more than an economic one. Consequently, the first condition for this is to have the political will to do so. This is the main condition. And after that, there are other practical conditions, such as building the human capital and reforming the private and public sectors. As for what is important in the human capital is that it has a problem in demand, not in supply. That's not that we have the lack of students or candidates, no. But the reason is that one does not focus on the quality of education, and the GCC countries focus only on the supply side. And if the supply is so, the demand must also be focused upon, and one should think beforehand where would all this graduate go, these graduates of the different international universities that we brought into our region, where will they go after they graduate if they can't get jobs? Even the private sector does not employ them, and the public sector has no opportunities for them. So reforming this is the main is a very necessity, and it's a general demand and necessity for achieving development. The problem with the public sector is one at the top of the summit and one on the bases. On the bases, the public sector uses the distribution of rent, and here we must distinguish between two things, between the function and the distribution, and the public sector should be linked to productivity, and that the distribution of the rent should not be by creating fictive or having what we call the mask unemployment. There are some ideas in this sector, for example, the distribution, a minimum of the rent to the citizens, and the rest should be linked to the productivity. This is something that is being applied in Alberta and Alaska. And if you think about, but before thinking of the basis, we must begin with the summit, that's to say, from the ministry level, and the minister who will begin apply the reforms. Finally, by using and appointing capable, qualified personnel that are able to create this human capital and to draw and implement good economic policies, and not only some administrative structures and leadership structures that all only objective is to collect the rent and bring in the loyal people around them and encourage corruption. Shukran. Dr. Hatem Shamfari from the Sultan Qaboos University.
First, I would like to for his invitation to speak to such a distinguished audience this evening. And I would like to say that for over half a century, countries in the region has been experimenting to diversify away from oil and gas to other industries, tourism, manufacturing, and agriculture, with very limited success. That's very obvious because oil and gas is extremely competitive and very efficient sector. And normally, if you want to diversify, you go from less competitive and less efficient sectors to more efficient one, and it seems that we are doing the opposite here. So for that, it was very challenging and it's very difficult to see a successful results. Half a century is more than sufficient for many countries that have experienced, each one of us know number of countries in mind. You can do huge transformation within half a century period, but yet that did not click here. And Khalid has highlighted already some of the challenges that he sees from the political economic point of view. One example that I would like to draw on is what happened in Houston as a city that was so dependent on oil production, which I refer to it, as Professor Michael Porter have said, it's an inherited wealth. So it's not much of a creativity to extract it, but then it has limited resources, and in our case, government dominates, and they are very inefficient in distributing and owning such resources. So to shift from such an inherited wealth to a creative wealth led by the private sector that tend to be quite abundant because it is very innovative, very productive, and the wealth tend to last much longer, has been very challenging in countries in the region. Houston have done the transformation. It looks like very smooth transformation that have happened. So from highly dependent on production to doing everything in the oil and gas, being the capital of the world in oil and gas, but not the production as a major factor there. So if you look for IT solution, if you look for insurance, banking, everything to do with oil is there, but not much of a production. And I would say this would have been the ideal situation. Now, within the oil and gas being so efficient, you would expect that we have a competitive advantage, and we do. Over the years, multinationals and national companies that are operating in the oil and gas sector has created an excellent skills for the locals. Yes, it is highly capital-intensive type of industry, but it suits us to a great extent because a lot of the countries here, many countries here, are very limited in term of their population. So to use that advantage that has been created over the years and the involvement of multinationals to upgrade the skills of the locals, that is a strength that we have not capitalized on. And for some reason, we have been shying away from looking within the sector to diversify. And one of the key reasons for diversification is to at least smooth the impact of the volatility of oil prices. So if we do more downstream activities, that's likely to smoothen the cycle that is very, very severe that we have experienced lately. And in the same time, we can create more value. And the big surprise that we see here, that most of the countries, from the largest Saudi Arabia to the smallest Bahrain, there's not much of the country value in the oil and gas. We are almost getting everything from outside. We have not created that local value, and that's quite surprising. And I look at one other aspect that I can see here. Oil and gas could be the spearhead of diversification. First, because it is endowed with skilled local forces, local labor force, and that skilled labor force can go into a number of directions. I'll give you an example for that. In Oman, for example, a lot of oil fields are very old. So when they produce oil, 90% of production is wastewater. They have to pump it up, and then they use it either by gas as an energy to inject for enhanced oil recovery or through thermal that we have been using lately. Oil, water is such a scarce commodity, and this can open up for us huge opportunities. We have not capitalized on that, especially when we combine the management of water resources with the solar renewable energy. This has not been a priority. We have been always, even within that, we have been highly consuming and not trying to indigenize such industries and trying to add to it the R&D. Institutions are not well integrated. Industries are quite far away from the oil and gas sector. And I see there is huge opportunities that can be created in the sphere of oil and gas, where manufacturing, R&D, financial services here today, if you look around in the region, you wanted to see who is leading in the financial sector, it's very difficult to distinguish an institution that can lead the way in a creative manner to help the country as well as the oil and gas sector. So everything we like to use in the financial sector is always foreign institutions. And foreign institutions can play a very important role as a partner, as we see in the oil production, but we have not capitalized on that. For some reason, we have ignored that. ICT is another sector that we can do a lot. And when we are looking at diversity within oil and gas, we're not servicing the local industry or regional one. We are looking at the global supply chain. If we can link up to it, there's definitely a lot of opportunities for employment, which is a bigger concern going forward in the region, as well as for being able to add value, to create wealth that has not been there. And this is likely to be less challenging, as Khaled was saying, in terms of the political challenge that will come along with the diversification. So using solar energy to treat water, for example, we are so heavily dependent on the water desalination. If solar can be there, we can save a lot on the efficiency, we can save a lot on the emission of undesirable gases in the global environment, and therefore there is a lot to be benefiting from there. The downstream is another big thing that we have not. Lately, obviously, Qatar is leading the way in terms of its downstream industry. They're expanding a lot. A lot can be done in the region because you can add more value to your products and you can weather these changes in the oil prices that are very cyclical, as we saw it in the past. But I would keep emphasizing this issue of in-value, in-country value. We have been talking about this in Oman for a while. Because of the nature of the oil production, because of the Arab Springs, it has opened up an opportunity for more work to be done and localized. But even localizing is not necessarily in Oman. We're talking about the region, and we're looking at more of a global industry. So if you can be competitive there, that definitely will open up an opportunity to be part of the global supply chain that we have been missing. I think in the Gulf, we can look at two examples in terms of countries. We can look at the Norway experience, less dependent, even though it's an oil company, a success model that we'd like to emulate. And then on the other hand, there is the failing state of Venezuela that we try to avoid. Going forward, given all the changes and the challenges ahead of us, where are we likely to end up? So we don't have much time to afford, as we did in the past. We, to some extent, we have been extremely lucky. Not much efforts, just oil prices has been creating a very high tide for us, and we are benefiting from that. How long can we stay be lucky? And we have to be quite careful about that. So again, if it's so difficult to diversify in sectors that are less productive and less competitive, like the oil and gas, why don't we look into the oil and gas? Why don't we use our competitive advantage, the skills that has been created, and the willingness of the multinationals to help if we are clear about where we're going? So with this, I would like to end my talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Nader, last but not least.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Good evening, everyone. So I was really thinking about how to tackle some of the issues of economic diversification a little bit differently. It's a topic that we've dealt with quite a bit. And I wanted to maybe focus a little bit on to kind of emphasize many of the key issues that were raised by Dr. Khalid and Dr. Hatim and Samantha, and then look a little bit more at the specific case of Qatar, since we are here, and there may be some very, there's a different situation in Qatar in many of these cases that is sometimes counterintuitive. But I'd like to start by kind of emphasizing where I'm starting from, and that's Samantha's point. She mentioned the issue of peak demand. I would like to emphasize that we might be seeing a very soon structural shifts in the energy sector. Solar energy now is essentially cheaper than oil. The renewable energy sector is growing faster than even natural gas. On the production side, on the consumption side, there are much more efficient technologies. And there's more linking up in terms of micro-producers and households to electricity grids and other forms of production, which may really disrupt and transform the energy sector. There's also big changes in how energy is stored, which is going to have huge impacts on the transportation sector if there's a leap forward there. So we quite reasonably may be witnessing a solid fundamental shift in the energy sector within 20 years. This is important for the region because when we talk about when we used to talk about diversification, we normally said, well, you know, Qatar has 100 years of gas left, or X country had 50 years of oil left. Yes, that's true. And going back to the price points, if the price points are much lower than that, then or are trending downwards, then there is a much more urgency involved in economically diversifying the economies of the region. And it's important to think about many of the indicators of diversification that we see kind of hide really what's going on. They're suggesting that the economies are diversifying, you know, quite considerably. But the fact remains that many of these other sectors are still linked to revenues from oil and gas. So you can look at revenues from oil and gas. You can say, as a share of GDP, they're going down. But then you start looking at all the other sectors that are counted on the other side, and you see that these sectors would not be where they are. Tourism, construction, manufacturing, were it not for the oil and gas sector and how it's being used to help these other sectors. So again, the reality we talk about is, let's very realistically say that within 20, 30 years, potentially, there could be a very solid change in the price points of oil and gas, and we need to deal with that now. Now, turning to the case of Qatar, I'm going to propose kind of, I had to think, there's many things to draw on in terms of diversification, economic diversification. I'll just talk about three points which I think are important and which were already touched on a little bit by my colleagues here. The first one is about employment. Dr. Khalid rightly pointed out that basically employment needs to shift from public sector employment to private sector employment. There's a big push for Saudization in the Emirates and Bahrain for moving people into the private sector. I'm going to suggest that Qatar is actually in a very reasonable position. And in fact, what we might call Qatarization, the way it's been applied, which is similar to how it's been applied in other countries, has actually been hurting the Qatar economy because of how it's being applied. In terms of a labor force, in terms of population, Qatar actually has a much smaller population. And it can really absorb a lot more people into the public sector or the public sector enterprises. So even though 81% of Qatari nationals work for either the public sector or a public sector enterprise. In addition, there's another 8% that are working in the mixed sector, so something to do with government. So fully 89% of the workforce is involved in the public sector and somehow. Unemployment in Qatar is at 1%, actually less than 1%. Unemployment among nationals is at 1%. Youth unemployment among Qatari nationals is at 2%. This is the lowest in the world as far as I know. As compared to unemployment among Saudi youth, which is at 42%. So when we say Saudization, yes, Saudi Arabia has a big problem. Young people are lining up for government jobs, which offer better benefits and better wages and better circumstances. And they're not being able to get in because 60% of the Saudi workforce, and Saudi Arabia is a country of 20 million Saudis, in addition to foreign workers and their families, they can't absorb anymore. And that's reflected on unemployment rates. We don't see that in Qatar. What we should be focusing on, as I think Dr. Khalid suggested, is building the capacity and the skill sets of young Qataris in those positions. Right now what's happening oftentimes is there's a race to Qatarize. Many companies have set a targets of 10% and 20% of the workforce being Qatari. Doing the math is not enough to go around. And what they end up doing is stealing different people from different organizations and promoting them rapidly. So you end up with young Qataris who haven't really developed the basic knowledge and experience necessary for some of the positions they're in. I think this race has been actually detrimental. And Qatar can actually benefit by taking a step back and thinking more strategically about developing its human capital and ensuring that it gets the right people in the right places and benefits from them to the most of its ability. The second point is private sector development. And again, we see many changes in Qatar, many evidence of private sector development. Oftentimes, this is led by government. So, you know, Qatar Airways, QMB, other government public sector enterprises are leading the way. We see less evidence of creating an enabling environment for the private sector. Yes, we can point to free zones. There's new free zones and there's opportunities and we're trying to bring foreign direct investment. But in many cases, about 30-40% of the companies applying for these free zones are based in Qatar. And the reason they're going there is because they're trying to avoid the regulations of the regular economy. And so the step really isn't to try to establish free zones as much as it's trying to create a better enabling environment for Qataris who want to start and grow their business. And some statistics are illustrative here. There was a survey done in 2014 about entrepreneurship in Qatar. We found that 64% of Qataris surveyed between the ages of 18 and 64, 64% wanted to start a business within 3 years, among the highest in the world. Given the wealth and the opportunity, this makes sense. 26% of Qataris were actively engaged in starting a business. That means they were taking steps to secure a place, get loans, or at the early stages of business activity. First 2 years of business activity. 26% is also among the highest in the world. The world average is 13%. Okay. Here's the kicker. 7% of Qataris surveyed said they had a business that had been established for more than 3 years. That's less than the world average of 8%. So aspirations, very high. Effort to start a business, also very high. Success in starting a business, not as high. And if you look at some of the indicators and pick your indicators, like the world doing business indicators, Qatar is not ranked very well. It's ranked 89th out of 190 countries in ease of starting a business. Some of the issues are access to credit and contracts and securing that you have good contract enforcement and minority stakeholder ensuring their rights. Access to credit is strange in a country with so much wealth. But the survey that we did showed that access to credit was one of the major reasons that Qataris chose to close down their business. What was happening is that they weren't getting the necessary... They were starting a business, and then they had cash flow problems that they weren't able to meet. They were drawing on their savings rather than actually going through institutions and eventually finding... When the time came for getting a loan, they weren't in a position to get it, and they went out of business. So there's a lot that can be done in terms of supporting Qataris to start and grow their business. This brings me to a third point, which I think is especially key for Qatar. And we don't talk about this much. It's the idea of wealth management. There's so much emphasis on diversification, but I think Qatar has the benefit of actually being able to grow its wealth. And this is at two levels. The national level, it already has a very large sovereign wealth fund, about $300 billion. But $300 billion, if you think of, let's say, a fundamental change in the price of energy, $300 billion is not enough to really give you enough return on that core investment to provide solid cushioning and alternative sources of revenue. As a share of the population, the United Arab Emirates is higher. They've already grown. Their sovereign wealth fund is the second highest in the world after Norway. Norway is also very high. I think Qatar should really focus on building that sovereign wealth fund to make sure that's diversified, because that's going to be the primary source of wealth generation in the future. The final point I want to make is this transfers down to the household level. I saw a very strange statistic. The average debt of Qatari households is actually very, very high. The number I was given, I haven't confirmed it in published sources, but it was from the ministry. I assume it's right. I want to verify it. Qataris are borrowing money, and they have debts, rather than actually accumulating wealth and managing their wealth. Moving towards thinking in terms of wealth management, even at the household level, I think would ensure the long-term sustainability, not only of the country, but actually of passing the wealth on to the future generations. So those are the three main points I wanted to bring up, and hopefully we can get a good discussion going afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Nader. I don't know about you, but I am overwhelmed. And I thought I know a little bit about this subject. I think the wealth of the information in the presentations we've heard speaks to the complexity of the problem and speaks to the multidimensional aspects associated with it. I want to get to the audience very quickly and open the floor for a Q&A. And some of you are already raising your hands. But let me just try in 1 minute to summarize what I think I heard. I'm obviously very close to where Dr. Khaled is. The problem starts with the system or with the model itself. You have to do something about the model. The basis of this model means policy will be distorted, initiatives will be short-sighted, resources will be misallocated, and if you are doing a lot of good things, maybe in the end it is not enough to get you where you want to go, not to mention the political issues. Samantha, on the other hand, reminded everyone that there is a sense of urgency now that's building up. Subhanallah al-Azim, just over a decade ago, we were talking about peak oil in the supply sense. Now we're talking about peak oil in the demand sense within the next decade or two. Thereby pressures are building up on getting whatever you're doing right. Hatem and Dr. Nader both were more, in my view, maybe practical, positive, or contrarian. Dear Hatem made me think, and I think he hopefully made you also think. Rather than think of oil and gas
as the opposite of diversification. Why not think of oil and gas as being an engine of diversification? After all, it's a sector where you have a competitive advantage, where you have high productivity, where you have skilled labor. And there is, and there are many examples of how this has happened. He pointed to Norway. He started off talking about the city of Houston and the transformation that has happened. So the message there is, work with what you have that you know how to work with best. And finally, Nader, I thought, was very helpful in reminding us that even within the challenges and the failures and the setbacks, there are some things that countries, some countries, are doing right in promoting private sector development, in promoting entrepreneurship, in promoting educational achievements. So rather than think of the system as being the problem, work within the system on what you can improve and work with the competitive advantages you have. These are just a 3-minute summary for me to try to organize my thoughts, and I hope it has helped you. So we'll open the floor right now, and we'll start. Hopefully you can make your questions brief, your remarks brief, and we'll try to push on our panelists to be also brief so we can give as many people an opportunity to speak. Start with Dr. Khaladi.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the panel. This is extremely provocative, I think. My question to Dr. Khalid Al-Khater, and linking up to the other views of the spectrum, which is what I have learned is as if we need a political change as a prerequisite to change the whole economic model. So if you have the rentier state as the main dominant model across the Gulf countries, so effectively we can't do any economic change in a serious manner that would kind of influence and have a new, let's say, diversification or any kind of change in economy. So to what extent that we can do something, we can do some incremental changes, as the other end of the spectrum have suggested, given this is it. This is the political system that we are living in. All of us aspire to have transparency, maybe constitutional, maybe democracies in the Gulf, but maybe this is far-fetched at the moment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you really very much for this nice event. Allow me to speak in Arabic before I introduce myself. I am Fahad Al-Marri, I'm a PhD student.
Yeah, and I am Fahad Al-Marri, and I am a PhD student. I have a question that I would like to pose here. In particular, when it comes to the title, which GCC are you talking about? So since 1980, it was established in 1980, and since it was established, we have seen a financial crisis, and the financial crisis started in 1973. So what I understand is that there is a problem, there is a kind of a problem when it comes to experts and governments. I think that there is a missing link. How can we think of not having an economic system? I do not generalize here. We have a number of experiences in the GCC countries. Let's get rid of this council. Let's talk only about countries of the GCC. We have a number of distinctive models in the GCC. I hope that there are going to be some concessions made by the other GCC countries in order to emulate this system. But the system of the State of Qatar is one of the distinctive economic systems, and the same applies to the economic, the political system of Kuwait, which is very distinctive indeed. Oman also is very distinctive when it comes to stability and also when it comes to diversity and giving the opportunity to a number of options to see light. So why do we see that oil is a source of a problem? And it is not a blessing, it's a curse. So we have to stand and look into this situation to ponder in order to put things in the right track. Thank you so much. We're going to take a third question, and after that we're going to come to you. A third question.
The distinguished speakers about the capital markets and their role in the boost and help of diversification in economy. Was this forgotten or on purpose? I haven't heard from speakers.
Can you repeat your question?
Markets and their role in the diversification and boost of economy. Was this done on purpose or this was forgotten?
In the name of God, the most compassionate, my question is about the production of oil in the USA from 2019-20. In 2020, we might see an increase in production of oil. To what extent is this going to impact development plans and the prices of oil in the GCC? This is the first question. The second question, what is the role that should be played by OPEC for the stability of oil prices, because this is the organization that should set the prices, that should set the level of productivity. How can it do its job? So we have seen a fluctuation when it comes to oil prices in the past. How can it control such a situation?
Can you take the last question?
Sure.
I think it was straight.
I'm happy to take the last question. As far as the production of oil in the USA, if you look at most estimates, they're continuing to go up. We're continuing to see productivity improvements, particularly with the price rise we've seen over the past year or so. You're seeing greater investment, you're seeing better productivity, and you're seeing anticipation of still greater oil production from the United States. There are a few infrastructure bottlenecks right now with respect to getting that oil out to sea, particularly with respect to pipeline capacity, but people are working very hard to correct those. There's a lot of money in correcting those, which tends to make things go a bit quicker. And so, yeah, we're still seeing rising production out of the States. With respect to OPEC, that is a terrific question. And the ongoing role of OPEC in this new world of abundance is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. One thing that I don't think is necessarily appreciated sometimes, the international oil companies, the Exxons and the Shells of the world, and you know the national oil companies that you see here in this region, I don't think people necessarily understand the difference in motivations between these two different types of companies. And that makes for some interesting discussions sometimes. This region and brought together under OPEC will continue to be the world's source of spare capacity. It doesn't make any sense for the international for-profit oil companies to keep capacity in reserve, and they don't. However, because the goals of the companies that operate in this region, the government oil companies, are quite different, it does make some sense for them to keep spare capacity, to bring online during times of disruption or during times of greater than anticipated demand, for instance. And so I think you will continue to see the countries in this region play that role, both because they have a somewhat political aspect to their production as well as an economic one, and also because the production costs are so much lower here that it's more economical to keep that kind of capacity online. So I think even in this age of more abundant oil supply, you'll continue to see a role for OPEC and for the countries of this region to help balance prices. I could talk about this ad nauseum all night, but I want to turn some of the questions over to others. But if you want to talk about this later, I can.
دكتور خالد كان في سؤالين لك على الأقل two questions one question
أحد الأسئلة
the room where the gentleman asked a question shouldn't we be distinguishing between the different models we see within the GCC
yes.
different countries have succeeded in different things
Yes, if I remember the question right, that you are saying, should we give up or should we try because it's a political issue? No, this is not my point. The point is that the an abundance of resources, unfortunately, looks like a barrier toward diversification. So what I'm trying to say, it's depend on the extent of the conflict of interest between the ruler and the ruled, the diversification result will come out. So the less conflict of interest, of objective between them, the more will be the positive outcome on diversification and on sustainable development. For instance, we can have example. Libya, for instance, is very rich in oil. However, the development-wise was underdeveloped. Other countries have done better. So it depends. For instance, even within the GCC themselves, the GCC state, Saudi Arabia versus Qatar, for instance. In another research I had, Saudi Arabia came in the curse area. There is an oil curse in the literature, and we figured it out, the puzzle. It's a curse. The curse depends on the oil management, on the distribution, the model that I explained, and the political system. So Saudi Arabia and Syria and Libya, I remember they were in the red region, like oil or natural resources were a curse. Qatar and other few countries, and Norway, and they were in the blessed area. So it depends on how you manage it, and it depends whether the leadership fears sustainable development or not. I have a pessimistic view, because experience-wise, country-wise experience, development, diversification happened by necessity. In the East Asian experience, for instance, that we now we highly praised, Malaysia, Indonesia, another country, I think Singapore, they or another country, I don't remember, but I am very sure about Malaysia, Indonesia, they diversified by necessity, meaning 3 decades ago when they start to run out of oil, they felt the urgency of diversification, because the oil that was calming the population is going to run out soon, then it's going to turn against them. So these government, they adopted reform, and then they adopted industrialization, and they become an industrialized country. So this is my point.
Okay.
So thank you.
Dr. Hatem, we did not talk about capital markets.
Sure.
And the role of capital.
I will take up Khaled Al-Hurub issue that he has raised regarding the political change, the need for political change to achieve diversification. I would like to emphasize the role of institutions. You have to strengthen the institutions. They play a key role for transformation. And if there is not strong institutional build-up and capacity, the effectiveness of the diversification will be very limited. The base of change has to be a leaping forward rather than incremental change. We have been doing a lot of incremental change in the past. I don't think we can afford that going forward. We have to leap forward to make any impact and make it sooner rather than later. And then the issue of oil being a curse, I don't agree with that. For GCC, it has been a blessing. If you don't, going forward, use it effectively, it could turn out to be a curse. But so far, it has been a blessing, and I don't agree with the point of it has been a curse. The capital market has not benefited from the diversification efforts. One of the reasons is that the capital market has never been, in some countries, a key focus of building up institutions, building up capacity. They have been sidelined, and unfortunately, the benefit in the capital market has been limited. When we needed the capital market, when oil prices were low, it was not there. It's not functional, and therefore we felt definitely there is a gap need to be addressed going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, did you want to comment on something? You want to come in on something?
Just briefly, I think for the gentleman, and this gets back a little bit to the point I was making. GCC countries, Gulf countries, have a lot in common in terms of interests of diversification, of ensuring closer cooperation. To some extent, the blockading countries are not acting in their national interest right now. There isn't interest in working together. That said, each country also has unique circumstances. And they can learn from each other, but they need to be careful not to emulate each other and just completely say, well, this is what's happening here. The circumstances are somewhat different in each place, and they need to be tailored to the needs of a specific situation of the country. But there's more that unites them than divides them, at least economically.
Shukran, Nader. The gentleman there, in the blue shirt. You raised your hand, right? Yes.
Thank you. I wanted to ask on the topic of diversification. There was no mention about in-country versus out-of-country diversification, because there's also the concept or school or one angle that says that no country can diversify as long as it continues to invest domestically. That this is not the ultimate diversification is to go overseas and invest in acquiring companies or having assets overseas that they own, they control. And when we look at Israel versus the Arab countries, Israel owns more investment companies in outside of Israel, held by Israeli ownership than all Arab countries combined, more than all Arab countries combined. And that is an element of diversification that I haven't heard mentioned. I wonder if someone wants to address it. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Saeed Abu Awda, in the front row.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to ask Dr. Khalid again, please. I want to follow up on the question of the gentleman, I think, in the first row. Dr. Khalid, for any country, in my opinion, or any region to do any serious change, to work on maximizing its potential, its productivity, and to develop its human resources, and to do a proper forward plan, there has to be a public consensus. There has to be a consensus where the public and the government agree. And therefore, I think the real challenge comes down to political development. Political development in the sense of how do you get the public in the GCC countries to be real partners in the decision-making process of the governments in utilizing public resources, oil and gas or otherwise. I think this is where you will be able to see change and to carry forward a change that everybody agrees on and is willing to support. Because individuals and subjects of rentier states who have certain expectations, it is not easy to change their attitudes and expectations unless you really get them to be part of a political system that gets them committed to the changes that are coming. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our colleague from Sudan.
I have two questions. Thank you for this important symposium. The first question, the GCC countries, some of them have gone into wars and regional conflicts and don't have political stability. So how can one think about developing their economies at a time that are in wars and conflicts and animosities? I think political stability should be discussed also, not to focus only on the economic aspects, because without political stability, one cannot do anything with the economy. Second, what is the future, the guarantee of the investments made by Gulf states abroad? Because it's very much possible that if any political differences happen or any changes, all these foreign investments outside might not have their revenues come back to them.
Management expert, and I've been in Qatar for a long time. I would just like to mention, in reference to what Dr. Khaled mentioned, I think in terms of the model that Qatar, for instance, uses, and I was part of the people that worked in terms of, you know, creating the Vision 2030 and so on, and the country was very aware of trying to create a knowledge-based economy. In fact, they've used help from the World Bank and so on. And so they're very focused on creating a knowledge-based economy and diversifying in the process. The problem actually comes in the execution, not in the model. When you come to execute, and the country has created, you know, Qatar Development Bank has created a lot of initiatives to try and encourage ICT sector and so on. But when it comes to the execution, there is an issue I think that Dr. Nader referred to, which is, you know, how much an interest would, you know, a young Qatari have in being in the private sector versus getting a very lavish and great government job. And that's difficult to deal with. Because, you know, the country wants to be very nice to its people, but at the same time, you expect to create more of a meritocracy. And that balance, in my opinion, is the hardest thing. So I don't think the model that Qatar in particular is following is an issue. But when it comes to executing in terms of, you know, ICT sector, you know, development and economic diversification, the issue comes in just being able to execute. And I don't know if there is a solution. I would look for, you know, Dr. Khaled or Dr. Nader to see if there is an, you know, way to balance that need. One example I want to mention, and I also live in Houston, is when you look at the states, even though the country is, you know, is full of very knowledgeable and educated people, but it's also open to people from outside. I mean, you have the CEOs of companies like Google, like Microsoft, who are actually from non-WASP, you know, non-white backgrounds, you know, Indian and so on. I mean, because you have a meritocracy that's open to people from Chinese origin, from everywhere, and that's what gets people to, you know, the economy to really prosper. And I think in the Gulf, that's a challenge. You have generous governments, and particularly in Qatar, trying to do everything for their people. But at the same time, how could you also be tough and create more of a meritocracy at the same time? I don't know if there is a solution to that.
We are running out of time, and we have. I want to go back to the speakers and give them a chance to comment, but perhaps I feel guilty not giving you a chance, so please be brief. There, gentlemen there.
Thank you. My name is Youssef Dawood from the Doha Institute. I am with Hatim's assessment of why diversification hasn't really worked well for other or all Gulf countries. One thing that wasn't mentioned is lack of other natural resources in the Gulf countries to accommodate that production of various other things or industrialization. Compare, for example, most of the Gulf countries with Iraq before the demise of Saddam Hussein, because Iraq has, and Syria to some degree, before they run out of oil, because they have other natural resources that they can use, agriculture and other minerals, that can be used for production, you find that there has been a little bit more diversification than have materialized within the Gulf countries. So I would tend to say that the assessment that let's look at forward and backward integration with the oil industry as a source of diversification would work probably better. Thank you.
Now our speakers, if you can be very brief, respond to whatever set of questions you think you want to say. I'll start with you, Samantha.
Yikes, I'm first. I don't know that I have answers to the questions, but I'm hearing kind of a theme in this second round of questions. And that's really the challenge of changing the social contract that citizens of the GCC have with their governments. And those social contracts, the GCC countries differ quite a bit. You look at Saudi Arabia with a much larger and much more diverse population versus Qatar with a much smaller population and still a huge resource base. So the challenges are slightly different. But in each case, the governments here are trying to find a way to change the nature of that, you know, if you keep us in power, we will make sure that we keep you wealthy, frankly. That's a rather crass way of looking at it, but it's not too far from the truth. And so there needs to be a way of sort of increasing the risk allowed, helping young people understand that some risk comes with some reward, and just changing the nature of that contract. And I think that's a really difficult thing to do, because it's not just an economic thing. It's a social and cultural thing about how young people expect to play out their careers and their lives. And I don't have a good solution to that. But I think we definitely, when you think about this, you need to go all the way back to sort of socio-cultural issues, even before you dive into some of the economic challenges.
Thank you, Samantha. This actually connects with the question that Saeed asked Dr. Khaled.
Yeah.
How do you give people a stake in the system? How do you make them want it?
That's the core of the question. That's what we have been talking about. I always have been saying economic reform goes hand in hand with political reform. You have to give people a stake in the development, you know, and therefore part of the reform for the private sector is to abstain from using capital expenditure as a rent extraction mechanism, or as recycling it into a certain group, the capital political group, and it has to be based on transparency, equal opportunity, fighting corruption and monopoly. All of these things we are trying to help the model without radically changing the political, having to change the political, not regime or baby mindset, or wait until we run out of oil to have serious change. The other thing is, you mentioned fancy development strategies everywhere, and in every country they always talk good. You know, they have good intention. They design a nice model, but it's always the problem with the application. And this is what we have been saying. And I'm not impressed by mentioning the World Bank or the IMF. What have they done? Destruction everywhere. So we know our problem, and we are more well-versed in our problem, but we are fantasizing by bringing experts from overseas to tell us what to do and what not to do. If they are serious, they would have listened to their expertise inside and develop their human capital and accumulate their capital and knowledge and then listen to them. I think the politician, when they are serious, they can do things. They can change stuff. But as long as we use the rent distribution mechanism for other purposes, as we have abundance of oil, I think the diversification process is going to slow down, and the sustainable development also will slow down.
Thank you, Dr. Khan.
I would like to say that one of the success of diversification is that you can invest internally and externally in a very efficient way. We look at the Singaporean model, where the sovereign wealth fund is going out to acquire companies and to bring them to Singapore. How much of that was happening here in the Gulf? Very limited. And we haven't paid enough attention to this, and this is very surprising. Part of which is because of the legacy of the government. When the government is managing the show in a very bureaucratic way, you tend to miss out a lot in terms of opportunities. Singapore have approached this in a very business-like mind, and their investment has definitely yielded a lot of value for them, as well as the Norwegian case. The issue of investing outside and the guarantee. When you invest, there's always risk. And one of the issues that you have to deal with is that you may be trapped somewhere, and that's part of the risk that you have to factor in. One of the challenges to invest in the region is that markets are very immature, extremely illiquid, and highly unpredictable. So obviously the mature markets offer opportunities, but that always comes with a risk. Some of the risks you can calculate, you can manage, you can reduce. Others you just have to take a hit if it happens, and you hope that your damage is not that bad. Thank you.
Neither. It's always hard to go last. I'll just stick to one question. I think there was a question about in-country versus out-of-country diversification. And I think I tried to address that in terms of wealth management. The Sovereign Wealth Fund is very much about investing outside of country and ensuring that you have long-term returns on your investments. And I think that's important and very key. Thinking about diversifying in-country, I go back to the idea. There's so many examples within the region. Let me focus on Qatar about innovation taking place. Right now, there's a team of students from Carnegie Mellon that essentially is on their way to MIT to present the design of a new product that is low-cost genetic testing for specific diseases that hasn't been designed anywhere else under the supervision of a faculty member. This is new. This is innovative. This can be patented. This can make a big difference in developing countries. That was designed here. You have one of the fastest translating service that was software translation services designed by the Qatar Computing Research Institute. That's available, and it's amazing technology that's being produced. One of the NGOs here developed an online peer-to-peer financial inclusion mechanism, lending mechanism, that won a prize, a global development prize given to it by Muhammad Yunus. All of these examples, however, really haven't transferred, because Qatar has invested a lot of money in this knowledge economy. Qatar now, if you look at the WEF's Global Competitive Index, it's actually on an innovation economy setting. The reason is because of the number of patents per capita that the countries actually manage. What's been happening, though, these have not managed to go to market. At every point, you have a new idea. There is infighting. There's institutional barriers. There is things that get stopped that prevent great innovative ideas from actually then going out, turning a profit, and becoming part of the diversification story in the country. So part of the reason is institutional. Our approach to supporting these entrepreneurs and everything else is top-down. And when something grows, it then eventually hits the top that supported it, and it doesn't always let it to flourish. It's not an ecosystem approach. It's not a bottom-up approach to internal economic diversification. And that's harming it. You can find similar examples across the countries of the region, unfortunately. So there's so much potential. To some extent, it's about kind of getting out of the way and supporting it to make it happen.
Thank you, Dr. Nader. This has been a very rich discussion. It's the first event, as I said, of our season, and I want to thank everyone for being a part of this event, for taking the time to be with us, for asking the questions. I can tell from looking at most of you that you're thinking. Many of you are taking notes. Even Abdullah Baboud, who's actually flown in today from Muscat to be with us. Stand up, Abdullah. Allah khalik. Ugof, please. You're a dear friend to all of us. Many of us are just happy to have you be here with us today. So thank you for blessing this gathering. And especially thanks to four panelists who've been very open, very forthcoming, very bold, and as was pointed out, very provocative. This is a discussion that will continue. We have one or two workshops scheduled on this issue in Doha and in Muscat, inshallah, in the next few months. We have public events coming up on some topics that might be of interest to you. Yemen, the challenge of reconstruction in post-conflict countries in the Arab world. We have an event coming up on China's Belt and Road Initiative. And we have an event on Turkey and the tremors that have been felt in emerging markets in our region on account of the economic dislocation. Please stay in touch with us. Come and be a part of these events. And please come and contribute. It makes this city the vibrant, lively place that it is, that makes us all very happy to be a part of it. And it really makes us all feel that we're part of one single community. But I have one final request before I close, and that is to please give a very nice, warm round of applause to our speakers.